Hello and welcome to the That Wired podcast. I'm your host, Madalina Jakob, co-managing editor of That Wired North America. Today, we're unpacking one of the fastest free falls into Chapter 11 in recent years, the case of troubled auto parts company First Brands Group. This is a story of red flags ignored, the financial reporting quirks that were treated like routine footnotes, the murky ownership structure no one on Wall Street pressed too hard to understand, and fraudulent practices that went unchecked. All this morphed into a high-stakes, drawn-out bankruptcy complete with looming litigation, a court-appointed examiner, and a restructuring support agreement that still has to see the light of day. We've assembled a full panel for today's discussion. Our reporter Kuni Yang and our head of credit research, Tim Hines, will talk about the red flags that Wall Street missed. Kuni has some eye-opening anecdotes from investors, so stay tuned. Our global head of legal analysis, Sarah Tapinikis, will identify the big fights starting to play out in the case, which could have significant impact on creditor recoveries. Taylor Harrison, That Wire's court reporter, will walk us through the latest developments in the case and what to expect next. Kuni, let's kick off the discussion with you. What brought First Brands onto your radar? Because this company was covered primarily by our reporters following the primary debt market, and you specialize particularly in writing about stressed and distressed companies.
So First Brands first came onto my radar in early July, and you're absolutely right. It was brought up by investor source, not as a distressed company, but as an opportunity to invest in this $1.5 billion private credit deal they were doing with Jeffrey at the time. So this is part of a more comprehensive cross-border $6 billion debt refinancing. My source was very optimistic about the deal at the time because, you know, First Brand was considered a solid business. It was an opportunity for private credit lenders to participate in this mega deal. But we, DebtWire as a publication, has a long history of covering those companies that ended up under First Brand's umbrella over the years, which goes back to 2004. Also, my colleagues on the primary market side have written extensively about the company's debt issuance over the years, while merger market reporters have been covering the founder Patrick Jim's aggressive acquisition spree.
Yes, we've been writing a lot about this company, but I want to go back to the time where investors were extremely optimistic about this deal, right? But ultimately, the refinancing was shelved in early August. So what happened back then, Kuni?
Right. The deal was paused just a month later in early August due to weak demand. So I went back to my source, was looking to participate. He said it was because there's a lack of financial clarity. He was still bullish at the time because this is a company with 40% market share, with 26,000 employees and factories around the world. At the time, the company also claimed that it has $1 billion of US dollar of cash just sitting on the balance sheet. And my source said, there's no reason for the company to miss any payment of any kind. But apparently, a lot of the other lenders, market participants were more hesitant. Our primary market team actually came back with this amazing exclusive story on August the 8th, right after the deal was shelved, which laid out all the red flags, not only led to the refinancing failure at the time, but also ultimately the collapse of the company.
Can you walk us through some of these major red flags?
First and foremost, this is a company that a lot of people thought was too good to be true on many levels. If you look at the guided pricing on the refi, it was extremely enticing, given the rating of the company and the level of debt it has. It offered 9% to 9.5% on the first lien and S plus 950 basis point with 95 to 96 OID on the second lien. One of the private credit lenders actually told me when First Brand approached them for the private credit tranche, the company just said, name your price, we'll pay whatever you want. And he was immediately alarmed because he said, we never got to name our price. And it was already a very expensive second lien debt, which would dramatically increase the company's interest burden. And you know what they say, the only people who don't care about the cost of borrowing are the people who don't intend to pay you back. So they eventually pass on the deal. Another thing that was really alarming to investors was the company's murky financial numbers. So First Brand's add backs account for about 40 to 60 5% of the EBITDA. If you take that out, you get about 3x leverage through the first lien and 4x leverage through the second lien compared to 1.8x and 2.6x based on a pro forma basis. And that's almost a turn higher. A lot of the investors were also questioning the company's margin. So auto companies don't usually have very high margins. But First Brand, it has around mid 30% compared to just 20% for its peers. So that kind of makes you wonder, is it really something that the company is doing that makes them so much better? Or was it something else? Because bear in mind, this is also a company that made 15 acquisitions over the past 15 years, making it even harder to understand the organic growth and revenue.
And I think one investor told Datwire that he doesn't mind adbacks when they're credible, right? But when things are going well, nobody really cares about adbacks. But when the music stops, a lot of questions can be raised.
Right, exactly. And for First Brand, the music really stopped very soon after, just a month after the failed refinancing, the file for Chapter 11. Tim, have you ever seen anything like this before?
Yes, you know, actually, Cooney, I've seen something like this before. Back in 2005, a automotive supplier called Collins and Aikman filed for bankruptcy, and it had about $2.3 billion of liabilities. And the CEO, David Stockman, was a very public figure. And, you know, sometimes I take issue with people talking about Patrick James not showing up on camera, and that was a red flag. David Stockman was always talking, leading conference calls. And ultimately, he was charged with improper round-tripping of rebates, and that was basically misbooking rebates, and then also charged with manipulating a borrowing base for a GE Capital loan. So there's a history of these kind of things with add-backs and some borrowing base manipulations, and this happens out in the public, but a lot of times investors get lulled into just taking add-backs and changes without really questioning what's going on. So yeah, I've really seen a problem like that before. And some of these issues are similar to what First Brands was accused of by Pittsburgh-based Tri-State Capital. They actually were part of a lawsuit saying that they were being accused of borrowing-based manipulation.
Interesting precedent, Tim. Going back to First Brands, I remember the refi raised a lot of questions about the structure of the deal. Some investors said that a reputable sponsor would have written at least $1 billion check, an equity check, which is quite ironic because as we've seen after the filing, the company really didn't have any money to write an equity check. They filed for bankruptcy with just $14 million of cash and no ability to pay their employees.
Yes, exactly, which is ironic because I was also talking to another investor who was looking to give the company money years ago, but was rejected at the time. This was way before Apollo shorted the loan, so around 2023. He was one of the few investors who had the capacity to do both term loan financing and the receivable financing. So he was requesting access to the two data rooms for First Brand's term loan and receivable financing loan. And he was immediately turned down. He thought it was a really big red flag, because why would you turn down people who are trying to give you money like that without even asking any questions? The only possible explanation is that the information in your two separate data rooms would not match and would show some sort of discrepancy that would give away some hints of malpractice or even fraud. And years later, right now, that is exactly what we are seeing right now in the bankruptcy court, where people are asking questions and looking into how the company might be cooking their books and double pledging their receivables.
Yeah, and what's really disturbing is that the company was in the market trying to raise $6 billion of debt, both here in the US and in Europe, when they were actually in default on $1.9 billion of equipment financing with inventory lesser onset. So they signed a forbearance agreement in May and were operating under that forbearance agreement when they came to the broadly syndicated market and were asking investors to give them money. Tim, what is your perspective on this?
Yeah, so if they were in a forbearance agreement, that should have been disclosed in the financing documents, and that was up to the underwriter to disclose those. It's very important for the underwriter to disclose everything, even if it's difficult to get the deal done. As long as it's disclosed and the investors understand the risks they're taking, it's important that it should be disclosed. It's my understanding it wasn't disclosed. It should have been disclosed.
So, Tim, you also took issue with the fact that the factoring financings were not set up properly. Can you share your thoughts on this?
Sure. So if you're working with a company that has low cash flow and really goes into asset-based lending, one of the things you want to do is make sure you don't give the company the opportunity to steal or misappropriate funds, because they may have done it in the past, and First Brands had been accused of that before. So what you do is set up safeguards. And specifically in this case, Jeffrey's Bonita Point Fund in an open letter said that the company had misappropriated funds that were supposed to go to Bonita Point. And I said to myself, how did that happen? And what was going on is First Brands actually collected the cash for Bonita Point and then was supposed to forward it to Bonita Point. That's a flaw in the system. That gave First Brands the opportunity to redirect the cash somewhere else instead of having that cash go directly to Bonita Point. So if you want to lend money to somebody that has a reputation of possibly not being straightforward and it's asset-based, you want to set up as many checks and balances and safeguards as you can to make sure the company doesn't steal. It's a really important thing.
And Tim, you have analyzed thousands of companies. Were the signs at First Brands relatively easy to identify, you know, the warning signs, or did they require a deeper analysis? How come Wall Street missed them?
I think that there's a lot of pressure for firms to deploy capital, especially in the private credit space. And I believe that specific checks that were normally done from traditional asset-based lenders were not done. And a specific example would be just a Google search, or even using a firm that does deep background analysis like Backpeak, were probably not employed. And that really comes up with the lawsuits, as I mentioned, with Tri-State Bank in Pittsburgh, as well as another lawsuit from Fortress. If you just did a simple Google search and used Patrick James lawsuits, you would have found those two lawsuits in open documentation. You would have read through those and saw that the company had a history of either not paying back funds or trying to misappropriate or manipulating a borrowing base. Those would have been warning flags that would have given you pause to invest in a situation like that.
And at this stage in most bankruptcies, you typically have some clarity on the fulcrum security and a rough sense of what an RSA might look like. But in this case, with all the fraudulent allegations that you just talked about and the financial picture being still so murky, no RSA is in sight. What does that signal to you about the complexity of this process?
Thank you. That's a great question. I think it's going to be a very complex reorganization. And it's going to involve a lot of parties. And Sarah's going to talk a little bit on about substantive consolidation, and that's really going to add to the complexities. But the company, you know, it's a well-established company. They have brands like Trico and Fram. The company will trade anywhere from 3 to 4 times. So there's value here. But we've really got to figure out who's going to get which value. And I also believe that the customers are going to have to help this company get out of bankruptcy, either by paying, contributing to the reorganization, or paying some receivables early. But it's definitely going to be a long, complicated process.
Yeah, we just talked about the lack of an RSA, and I would like to bring Sarah in and ask you, Sarah, based on what you have seen in this case so far, what are some of the biggest disputes you think will shape the bankruptcy process?
Well, Madalena, I think we'll have a very active unsecured creditors committee in this case that will want to investigate not just the fraud allegations, because that's something that the examiner will be looking into, which Taylor will talk about later on. But I think they're also going to want to investigate the propriety of pre-petition liens. I think we'll also see challenges to the SPV structures, and I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a motion for substantive consolidation here too.
Very interesting, and we'll go deeper into all these topics. And we also know that the company secured a $4.4 billion DIP loan that was contested, and it was ultimately approved. How is that relevant, Sarah, do you think, to the fights we will see playing the case?
Yeah, so there were over 20 objections to the First Brands DIP loan, making it one of the most contested DIPs I can remember seeing in a really long time. But what stood out even more than that to me were the objecting parties' allegations that the provisions of the DIP loan would basically tie the hands of the Unsecured Creditors Committee and SPV lenders later on in the case. and then how the DIP lenders reacted and ultimately relented and agreed to change provisions of the DIP agreement. So for example, one thing was, as it was originally proposed, the DIP lenders would have gotten liens on not just avoidance action proceeds, but also on the avoidance actions themselves. And when I talk about avoidance actions, I mean the right to claw back money by bringing actions to recover pre-petition fraudulent conveyances and preferential transfers. So while it's common to give DIP lenders a lien on avoidance action proceeds, it's really not all that common to give them a lien on the actions themselves, because that effectively would give the DIP lenders the power to decide which actions to bring and which actions to refuse to bring. So here the DIP lenders ultimately agreed not to take liens on those actions and to only take liens on the avoidance actions proceeds. Another provision of the DIP that the Unsecured Creditors Committee opposed was that the DIP lenders wanted the committee to only have 60 days from its formation to investigate potential avoidance actions, and they wanted to limit the committee's budget to $50,000. So the DIP lenders ultimately agreed that that wasn't adequate for the case, given what we've all been talking about the allegations into First Brand's activities pre-petition. So now the UCC has until January 31st to investigate, and their budget went up from $50,000 to $250,000. So that was a pretty big jump for the DIP lenders to agree to. And then lastly, with respect to the SPV lenders, those lenders objected to the DIP lenders having any liens on assets belonging to the SPV debtors. And the DIP lenders agreed that they would not take liens on assets of the SPV debtors.
Sarah, can you break it down for us a bit? Why do companies form these special purpose vehicles, SPVs?
So SPVs are designed to be bankruptcy remote structures. They're used in different types of financing, like receivable financings that allow lenders to loan against the value of the assets rather than the creditworthiness of the borrower. So in these situations, the SPVs are set up to protect the lender by segregating the assets and minimizing the risk that the SPV can file for bankruptcy. So in order to do this, the parties put restrictions in the formational documents of the SPV entity and in loan agreements. Some of these restrictions, which we'll talk about, are going to be very important in this case, are that the SPV must always have at least one independent manager or director whose consent is required for a bankruptcy filing. They also have a provision in the documents stating that regardless of what is required under state law, directors' duties are owed only to the SPV and the creditors, and specifically not to shareholders. And in these cases, usually the SPV lenders are the only creditors. The documents also provide that the assets that are being financed must be segregated, and that if anyone wants to replace the independent manager, they need to give advance notice before the replacement to the agent on the loan. And there are also additional restrictions in the documents in terms of replacing the independent directors and managers.
So did the entities tied to First Brands, did they have these limitations in their documents?
According to the Carnegie lenders and Aquam Capital Finance, who each lent to SPV debtors, yes, they did. They had independent manager requirements with respect to bankruptcy filings and other limitations on replacing those managers.
But if the documents had all those restrictions, how did they end up in Chapter 11 anyway?
The lenders say that First Brands replaced the independent managers on the eve of the bankruptcy filings in violation of the agreements, and then replaced them with new independent managers who authorized the bankruptcy filings. So now these lenders have moved to dismiss the Chapter 11 cases of their respective SPV debtor borrowers on a number of grounds, including that the SPV debtors' cases were filed without proper authorization.
So how did the First Brands respond to these claims?
So First Brands hasn't responded to the motions to dismiss yet, but they clearly were aware that this was going to become a problem later down the road. Because at the outset of the case, First Brands interim CEO, Charles Moore, made clear that the debtors would be challenging these SPV structures. Specifically, he said that based on the debtors' professionals' investigations, they have serious questions about whether certain of the SPV lenders even have any collateral. And if they do have liens on assets, they also have questions about the priority of their liens as compared to other pre-petition lenders, namely the ABL lenders and the term loan lenders. Moore also said that according to their investigation, the collateral was never even transferred. It stayed on the debtor's books and records, and the debtors even continue to have physical possession over the property. So that's also going to be an issue. He's also said that the investigation showed that the assets were never segregated. In cases where they may have been turned over, there might not have been adequate consideration. So that's another thing we're going to see in terms of an SPV structure fight. And lastly, of course, he pointed to the fraud allegations in the case, including missing cash, fabricated invoices, tainted books and records, and double, maybe even triple or more pledged collateral. So, you know, all of these allegations bring to mind the Chapter 11 case of Enron, which also involved fraud and off-balance sheet transactions. And while that case was pending, Harvey Miller was giving a speech to the bankruptcy bar and other restructuring professionals, and he asked us if we knew what EBITDA was, which was a surprising question given the audience. But Harvey was actually telling a joke, and at the time he was saying, it now stands for earnings before I trick the dumb accountants.
Enron is, of course, the textbook example of corporate fraud, executives cooking the books and leaving creditors out in the dark. But yeah, that was a good one. I think I would like to bring in our court team editor, Taylor Harrison, now to break down how the fraud allegations have been handled in the First Brands case.
Thanks, Madalena. So at this point in the case, everyone agrees now that an examiner needs to be appointed because of the huge scale of the alleged fraud that we've seen in this case. But what still is being ironed out right now is the scope of the investigation and what the budget would look like. If appointed, and it looks like they will be appointed because the judge has already agreed to do it, if they can manage the scope, the examiner would be a neutral party and they would look into what fraud occurred, what mismanagement might have occurred, and how that was able to happen. So the examiner's findings could benefit creditors in the case significantly because it could shed light into how billions of dollars went missing, and that ultimately could help creditors pursue claims and causes of action to enhance their recoveries, or rather have the state pursue the recoveries on behalf of the creditors, and then they would get a bigger distribution potentially based on that. So UCC member Ray Stone in particular was commenting on this and said the company's funds simply vanished without any kind of explanation. And now all the parties involved in the case, including First Brands themselves, are saying that nobody really knows where these funds went. And that's a huge problem. So another neutral party that can actually be appointed in these types of cases is a Chapter 11 trustee. But that's pretty different than an examiner, because in the Chapter 11 trustee's case, they take over for management. They run the whole thing going forward. And an examiner is just going to be investigating a specific set of circumstances. So an examiner is a pretty rare appointment in Chapter 11 cases. Most bankruptcies typically don't need to have one appointed.
As you said, Taylor, we don't really see examiners appointed all the time. But can you walk us through another case where it actually happened?
So yes, FTX Trading was another really major case for us that had an examiner appointment. Like here, their founder and other members of management were accused of widespread fraud that led to their whole collapse into bankruptcy. So we're looking at fairly similar circumstances in First Brands with regard to the alleged fraud.
Right. So can you tell us, Taylor, what the examiner could investigate in this case?
So once the scope of the investigation is set by a court order, it's pretty locked in. There's only so much an examiner can kind of dig into. That's intentional because the judge, the debtors, other parties, pretty much nobody is going to want an investigation that drags on really long, covers irrelevant issues, and just drives up costs, keeps the company stuck in bankruptcy. That doesn't help anyone. So that's the reason for the limitations. And another big piece of this bankruptcy, in addition to the examiner, is an adversary complaint, which the debtors filed against their founder and the former CEO, Patrick James. In their complaint, they've alleged that James misappropriated hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars, which they say ultimately is what kind of pushed the company into Chapter 11.
There are some pretty vivid allegations against Patrick James that came up in hearings and court documents.
Yes. So the debtors have accused him of using either non-existent, falsified, doctored invoices to get at least $2.3 billion in account receivable factoring. And then they're saying he took another $2.3 billion by double pledging collateral. So even the judge in the case at one of the hearings noted there are red flags everywhere in the cash management system at this point. And the debtors also say that James moved company money into his own accounts and affiliated entities, which would include about $3 million that he allegedly took to use for rent at a New York townhouse for between 2019 and 2024. And then the kicker, one of the debtor's attorneys suggested that he may have spent around $500,000 of company funds on a private celebrity chef just this year, and then $150,000 on a celebrity trainer in addition to that. So in his defense, James has said that the company's collapse was not because of that, that's not what happened. What actually happened was that there were external forces beyond the company's control that led to this, like the Trump administration's tariffs and things like that. So James and the other defendants in the complaint basically argued that the debtors have just accused the founder of fraud or smearing him, saying he took money, but they don't have any details to provide that or proof at this point. So he's just basically saying they're using the smear campaign to get his assets frozen. So the debtors asked their bankruptcy judge for a preliminary injunction that would keep James' assets frozen for a longer period than just a temporary restraining order. But the judge said no. He argued basically that the risk of James dissipating assets going forward, especially because he's not the CEO anymore, was speculative and not imminent. And the judge also noted that even if James did do the things he's accused of, it does not appear to have been done in the dark by only one person, even if James was in charge of the overall purported scheme.
Yeah, thank you, Taylor. There's a lot more to uncover for sure. And it looks like we're gearing for a long, messy, litigious bankruptcy.
Yes, absolutely, Madalena. And given the fraud allegations and more saying that First Brands entities failed to observe corporate formalities and commingled assets, those are just tee-ups, in my opinion, for an argument for substantive consolidation. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a substantive consolidation motion here, what's often referred to as subcon. Subcon is an equitable remedy that bankruptcy courts rarely apply, but is applied when all of the assets and liabilities of multiple debtors within a group are so intertwined between each other that it would be nearly impossible to determine who owns what, sort of like unscrambling an egg. And subcon is one of the main reasons why SPVs are set up, because lenders want to keep their collateral out of the reach of other creditors in a bankruptcy case. So either way, the case is definitely going to be messy, and a lot of time and resources will go into investigating where the money went. And then even when that's all sorted, even more time and money will go into trying to recover those assets.
Sarah, that was a great analysis. It really helped me understand that. How do you think this is going to impact different creditors, specifically the secured creditors and the unsecured creditors?
So just to be clear, Tim, subcon does not operate to invalidate liens. And in terms of which creditors it would benefit, it usually benefits unsecured creditors of debtors that have little to no assets by effectively allowing those creditors to recover from a larger pool of assets, including debtors that have more assets than their particular debtor. But on the flip side of this, it's often to the detriment of creditors who have claims against debtors who have the most assets, because after subcon is applied, those assets will be generally available for everyone to recover, including creditors of other debtors. But again, I'm talking here about unencumbered assets. So this mostly applies to general unsecured credit.
Wow, that's pretty interesting, Sarah. So there could be some upside opportunity for trade claims or claims for general unsecured creditors. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Madalena.
Subcon is rare for a reason, right? Once you merge estates, you can't easily unscramble that egg. So creditors know it, judges know it. That's why the bar is sky high. On this note, we will wrap it up. Thanks, everyone, for all your insights. Thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of DebtWired. Our team is available to answer further questions. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode on Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at thatwire.com.